his remarks will be labor unions and public policy. Especially today, I'm going to be in a lot of law, especially the history of law, because you can't understand this problem unless you go back and see how it developed. In 1959, Congress passed an act, the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, usually known as the Landrum-Griffin Bill, which attempted to regulate the internal affairs of labor unions. The section of the act that was most talked about was the so-called Bill of Rights for Union Members. The attitude which most of the public took toward it was that this was a law designed to protect the union member from the from exploitation by his own union. Well, as you can imagine, the labor leaders of the country were by and large unhappy about the bill. And one of the complaints that they frequently registered was that it just wasn't fair. Congress didn't run around interfering with the internal affairs of churches and country clubs. Why should it interfere with the internal affairs of labor unions? After all, a labor union was a private organization. Congress had no right to set up rules about what the union could do and couldn't do. But this argument, I think, I'm convinced, is beside the point. Because Congress has, especially over the last 30 years, singled unions out as peculiar objects for public policy. Put it most simply, Congress has given to unions all sorts of special privileges. And as usually happens, when you get special privileges, you may find yourself under special restrictions. A union is not a private organization in anything like the sense in which a country club is. Today, unions are surrounded by a great deal of controversy. Perhaps they always have been, but maybe the controversy is more important today because unions have become very important in our economic system and in our whole social system. What I want to do is go back to see how we got to where we are, and whether we landed where we wanted to land. If the schedule holds, that's going to depend on how much you interrupt. You're welcome to interrupt anytime. But if the schedule holds, today will be pretty much factual. Although Byrne would insist that nothing I say is factual. It is true. I mean, it's all the facts I choose are the facts that seem to me to illuminate the problem. And what I call illumination may be what some would call obfuscation. But I'm going to stick pretty much to history today. And on Wednesday, the fireworks should begin as I attempt to draw some conclusions which will please no one. If my voice holds up. A good place to begin is with the Sherman Act, which we talked about last week. This is the basic antitrust law of the United States. And Section 1 of the Sherman Act says in ringing tones that every contract, combination, or conspiracy in restraint of trade in interstate commerce is illegal. This act was passed in 1890, at a time when the public conscience was very much aroused by the growth of trusts, which is a sort of a loose term for big business, combinations of capital that were supposedly doing all sorts of horrible things. It was a popular act, I think. Most people felt that Congress ought to do something about such giants as Standard Oil and the beef trust, the cattle trust, I guess they're the same thing, aren't they? The jute bag trust, the linseed oil trust, there are about 104 of them. The whiskey trust, one very much concerned all of us. But Sam Gompers, who was the founder and longtime president of the American Federation of Labor, contended in his autobiography that at the time Congress was considering this bill, Gompers recognized that it was a very dangerous bill for organized labor, and he says he opposed it consistently. He did not join in the hue and cry after the large corporation, because when you stop to think about it, that phrase, combination in restraint of trade, beautifully describes a labor union. And if every combination in restraint of trade is illegal, labor unions may be illegal. And Gompers' fears were largely realized. As the federal courts looked around, and some of the federal district attorneys, for combinations in restraint of trade, their eye did hit occasionally upon labor unions. And a large number of the convictions in the early years of the Sherman Act were convictions of labor unions for, well, organizing strikes or boycotts that interfered with the flow of goods in interstate commerce. Well, this made Sam Gompers and the leaders of organized labor quite unhappy. And they called for some kind of amendment to the Sherman Act which would clarify the intention of Congress. And it is still debated by historians whether Congress did or did not intend labor unions to be included in the prohibitions of the Sherman Act. But now, meanwhile, something else happened about the same time. Employers of labor discovered that a very, very effective device for breaking strikes was the injunction. Now, if I can oversimplify, a court injunction is a device for keeping people from doing things which they may or may not have a right to do, but for which there's no remedy if they go ahead and do it and they didn't have a right to do it. Like, you got a big oak tree in your backyard and your neighbor claims it's in his yard, and so he says, I'm going to take an axe to it and cut it down. And out he goes with his axe. Now suppose he cuts it down and then you find out that you prove that it's completely in your territory and he had no right to cut it down. What is your remedy? You can't put the tree back up. And suppose that he's very poor, so you can't get any money damages out of him. Now this would be an action for which there's no remedy at law. So you quick run to the judge, and the judge issues a restraining order. He says to him, do not cut that tree down until we have a chance to adjudicate this and see whether you have a right to cut the tree down. That's basically what an injunction is. It's a device to secure equity, fairness, and dealings among men. Now suppose an employer claims, he finds out that a union is about to strike, and he goes to his friend, the judge, and it's quite possible that the judge would have been his friend, they were members of the same class and society, gets him out of bed at night and says, hey, my boys are going to strike. If they do, this is going to cause a lot of financial damage to me, and the union doesn't have any money. I'll never be able to recover the damages, so tell them they can't. So the workers come down to the plant the next day with their picket signs all prepared to organize a strike, and here's a very official looking notice on the door forbidding all people whatsoever from in any way organizing a stoppage of work, or, you know. And this is pretty terrifying to workers, uneducated people, perhaps immigrants. Here is the majesty of the courts of the United States arrayed against them. Generally, it didn't take any more than this. Long before the thing would be adjudicated, long before the courts had a chance to decide that the workers did have a right to strike, the strike would be broken. This would give the employer a little time. You'd ferret out the ringleaders of the strike, fire them, and the labor injunction, as it was called, proved to be an extraordinarily useful device for employers in breaking strikes and keeping unions from securing any of their demands. It was very well advertised in 1894 and 95 by Eugene Debs. Eugene Debs was the head of the American Railway Union, which had organized the strike against the Pullman Company that led to a stoppage of the railroads coming into Chicago in 1894. And the federal government got an injunction against this because it was interfering with the mails, and finally the militia was called out, and Debs went ahead and tried to violate the injunction by continuing the strike. He finally got racked up for this. But then he talked to the newspapers afterwards, and it's interesting to read his statements. He says, the strike would have worked. We would have gotten away with it, but for one thing, the labor injunction. The injunction is a device that really hurts unions. I do not see how unions can function against the injunction. Any employer who goes and gets an injunction has really got us over the barrel. Well, employers read, And you can see, just see the curve of labor injunctions go up like that after Debs issues his advertisement. So these two things now, coming at about the same time, just before the end of the century, got the leaders of organized labor very upset. Here, it seemed, was a law on the books that made unions illegal, or practically illegal, the Sherman Act. And in addition, this device of the injunction, which prevented unions from doing anything, which sort of emasculated them before they had a chance to strike. And so labor began pressing for amendments to the law. And in 1914, they got the Clayton Act, or they thought they got the Clayton Act. When the Clayton Act was passed, Sam Gompers hailed it as the Magna Carta of organized labor, its charter of freedom. Two things that the Clayton Act seemed to do. It seemed to tell the federal courts, thou shalt not issue injunctions in labor disputes. And it seemed to say that labor is not an article of commerce, it's not a commodity, and therefore it doesn't count under the Sherman Act. But there were some important weasel words in the Clayton Act. Maybe they're not weasel words at all, I don't know, but they were, it turned out to be rather weaselly words. In particular, the word lawful. The way Congress drafted the relevant sections of the Clayton Act, Congress said that nothing in the Sherman Act, well, let me take the injunction thing. It said that the federal courts should not issue injunctions against lawful organizations when they are lawfully pursuing lawful ends. yeah, now that's very nice. But he's opened the question of what is lawful. And in the 1920s, the courts were inclined, frequently, I think this would definitely be true of the Supreme Court, to believe that a strike or a boycott or picketing was of dubious lawfulness. You find statements, I believe it was Chief Justice Taft who wrote the decision which said that peaceful picketing is a contradiction in terms. Now, the courts were not holding that strikes, boycotts, and picketing were illegal, but that possibility was very close to the surface. And there was always the danger that a union which organized a strike or a boycott or sent out pickets could be hauled up before the courts and punished in some way for this, or at least have its activity enjoined. Well, now, in the 1920s, this went down pretty well. If you think back to the 1920s, whether personally or through the medium of the history books, this was the era of business. As Calvin Coolidge said, America's business is business. And we had entrusted the future of the nation to the businessman. And why not? He was doing a marvelous job. It was a new era. Prosperity was going to be available for everyone. All you had to do was save a few dollars a week and put it in the stock market, and you too would share in the vision, the glory, and the promise of America. And what did we need labor unions for? Labor unions were foreign importations. They were devices to restrict production and restrict opportunity and hold a good man back. Membership in labor unions was declining steadily through the 1920s, and nobody had much of an interest in them. Even the labor leaders themselves were wondering whether they shouldn't get out of the labor racket and get into the stock market. Well, then came 1929. That changed things. The stock market wasn't the only thing that crashed in 1929. A lot of idols were smashed at the same time. I think that the years from 1929 to 1932 are crucial for an understanding of the age in which we live, even though nowadays most people don't remember that. America underwent a transformation from 29 to 32. We saw old idols really ground in the dust. The things which we had assumed to be true were proved to be very untrue indeed. We thought they were very untrue indeed. And we began to wonder whether maybe the businessman was all the hot stuff that we had supposed he was. We started looking around for other organizations, other institutions, other people who might pick up the mantle of business. Now, at the same time, two lawyers, students of law, had come out with a book on the labor injunction, a very well-documented book showing what had happened when employers applied to courts for injunctions in labor disputes. It's a reasonably objective book, but you can't read it without getting a certain amount of indignation welling up inside you, and I think this is exactly what the authors of the book intended. One of them is a name well known to you. The book was called The Labor Injunction. One of them is Felix Frankfurter, who died recently. This was before, of course, he was appointed to the Supreme Court. But this book had a tremendous influence and led, in large part then, to passage in 1932 of the Norris LaGuardia Act. Senator Norris, the TVA man, senator from Nebraska, and Fiorello LaGuardia. That's right, yeah. Norris, yeah, those men. This act, which was made possible by both the book and the change of opinion, did a number of things, but most importantly, it clarified Congress's intention in the Clayton Act. In case Congress had missed the point, I mean, in case the courts had missed the point, Congress was saying now in 1932, we meant that you guys are not supposed to issue injunctions in labor disputes. Got it? That may be a little simplification, but that's about what it said. Did a few other little things. It, for example, declared the yellow dog contract unenforceable. This was a device which an employer would use to keep the unions out. He would make every employee sign a contract before hiring him, stating that he would not join a union, and if he did join a union, he would consider his employment automatically terminated. And then if the employee joined a union, just get rid of him, and if he had any complaints, just pull out that contract. Well, these contracts were declared contrary to public policy in the Norris LaGuardia Act and non-enforceable. But the Norris LaGuardia Act did another thing. It had a little preamble. Congress likes to begin with some resounding statements of purpose, and Congress said that it was the policy of the United States government to promote collective bargaining. Now, this was a radical change. The policy of the government to promote collective bargaining. When in the 1920s, some people would say the government was actually neutral, or I think the net effect of government action in this area was to discourage collective bargaining. But now Congress was saying it's the policy of the United States to promote collective bargaining. 1 year later, the National Industrial Recovery Act was passed. This was the law which was the heart of Franklin D. Roosevelt's first New Deal, the first 4 years of his administration. The National Industrial Recovery Act is a very famous attempt to secure prosperity by restricting production, to have more by producing less. It was, I toss off an aside here, an abysmal failure, but finally in 1935 it was declared unconstitutional. And this meant that along with the rest of the act went a little section in which Congress had tried to compel employers to recognize unions, along with all of the other restrictive devices that Congress was trying to encourage or set up directly. It wanted to set up labor unions. The idea was to keep prices high and keep wages high and keep everything up and thereby get the economy up. The basic theory behind it, I think, is this. In periods of prosperity, we all notice prices and wages rise. Right? That happens. In periods of depression, prices and wages fall. So, if we can push prices and wages up, we'll get prosperity. Like saying, when it's wet, the sidewalks and the streets, I mean, when it's raining, the sidewalks and the streets are wet. Therefore, if we want rain, hose down the sidewalks and streets. But anyway, rather than pick on the NIRA, almost as soon as this act was declared unconstitutional, and so Congress's attempt to give a little legal encouragement to labor unions fell by the wayside too. Senator Wagner of New York, the father of the present mayor of New York, was ready with a new act, the bill which is still today the core of our federal labor policy, the National Labor Relations Act, or it's usually known as the Wagner Act. In 1935, Congress passed this law. Now, I want to single out three things about this law that are very important to notice. Section 7 of the law, and you're not responsible for this on an examination, so you can forget that it's Section 7. Section 7 of the law says that it's the policy of the United States government to promote collective bargaining, and it says that every worker has the right to choose representatives and to determine his wages and his conditions of employment by bargaining with management through those representatives. This is a right. Workers have this right to choose their representatives and bargain with management through those representatives in order to determine their wages and other conditions of employment. Now, when Congress states that something is a right, as Vern would tell you, it isn't doing much unless it sets up sanctions, guarantees, unless it provides a machinery to make those rights effective. And this Congress did by going on with Section 8 and then establishing the National Labor Relations Board. Section 8 of the Wagner Act lists five management unfair labor practices, five things that employers are forbidden to do. The most important of these are two, the first and the third. The first one is very sweeping. It says it's an unfair labor practice for an employer to interfere or restrain workers or coerce them in any way in their choice of a bargaining representative. Interfere is a sweeping word. And the way it came to be interpreted very quickly by the National Labor Relations Board and the courts is that there isn't much of anything that an employer can do to influence the decision of his employees. He's not supposed to even, in some cases it was held, he's not even supposed to tell them he doesn't like the union. He's supposed to keep his big mouth shut. It's none of his cotton-picking business. That was modified later on. But he could not, in Section 3 now, the third, 8.3, made this very clear. He could not fire workers for joining unions, or fail to promote them, or in any way discriminate against an employee because he was gung-ho the union. Now that pretty much tied the hands of employers when it came to breaking unions. And to make sure that the employee knew his rights and that his rights were protected, Congress established the National Labor Relations Board, which received complaints, and a complaint could be entered by any party who could demonstrate his interest in the outcome, and attempted to investigate, get out all the facts, and then issued an order. If it found, for example, that an employer had discharged a guy, and it looked as though the employer said, well, I discharged him because he was incompetent, but it looked suspiciously like he had discharged the guy because he was a ringleader in an attempt to organize a union, the NLRB would order the employer to put him back on the job. And if the employer refused, the NLRB could go to the federal courts, and the courts could issue an order telling him to do so. This worked pretty well. It worked very well, in fact, if by very well you mean that it got unions going. The membership of American labor unions jumped between 1935 and 1945 about threefold. In 1936, there wasn't any such thing as the CIO. In 1940, the CIO had more members than the AF-LL. Between 1937 and 1940, these industries, which we think of today as strongly unionized, got to be unionized. Steel, automobiles, electrical equipment. This all happened between 37 and, well, push it up to 41 to get a couple of steel companies and Ford Motor Company in. And it happened as a direct result of the Wagner Act, because the authority and the power of the federal government was thrown behind unions. Because the federal government said, we want workers to choose a union to represent them, and we don't want anybody interfering with that. As just judged in terms of effectiveness, the Wagner Act was a resounding success. Why did we do this? Well, you can take a look at the preamble to the Wagner Act and see what why Congress said we did it, but I have the feeling that preambles to acts are more rationalization than reason. One of the things that Congress is always trying to do in the preamble is provide the Supreme Court with some reasons for not declaring the act unconstitutional. And there was good reason to suspect in 1935 that this act might not survive the courts. When in 1937, the Supreme Court held that the act was constitutional, there were a lot of mighty surprised lawyers in the country. I'm not going to go into the reasons Congress gave in the preamble because I don't think they were the real reasons. Come back to that on Wednesday. But now, to skip lightly over a bit of history, the newfound power of labor unions was not always used wisely. This wasn't completely the fault of the labor unions. Nothing is ever completely anybody's fault. Things are too complicated in social life. It was in part the fault of the National Labor Relations Board, which didn't always use wisdom and discretion. Part of it was the fault of the public, too, which was, I think, a little bit naive about what could happen through giving unions more power. But anyway, from 1935 through the war years, the public became increasingly disturbed about the power of labor unions. They recognized that just because people belonged to the proletariat, that didn't make them saintly, and that unions were capable of abusing power just as much as corporations were. And then after World War II, a whole raft of strikes came. We've never had a year like 1946 in terms of number of strikes, number of people involved, length and severity. Looking back now from the perspective of almost 20 years, everyone, almost everyone agrees that it wasn't the union's fault. They had been under a kind of no-strike pledge throughout the war, and prices were rising, and as soon as we yanked off price controls, prices shot up in 46, shot up rapidly. People had bonds in the bank, which they could cash in the safe deposit box. They had huge savings accounts and checking accounts, and everything was worn out. Everybody wanted a new car and a new refrigerator. People wanted butter and cigarettes and the other goodies they hadn't been able to get during the war. It was a tremendous increase in demand, and we simply weren't capable of turning out the goods and services fast enough to meet the demand. So we had inflation, of course, and the unions and union members could see that prices were rising faster than wages, and they kept trying to keep up. The public got this sort of confused. The public noticed that prices were rising. They noticed that unions were striking for higher wages, and they assumed, as we always do without finding a villain, that it was the unions that were causing the prices to rise. But the combination of inflation, the supposed union role in causing inflation, and the large number of strikes, including some strikes which were conducted in a very foolish way. John L. Lewis did a great deal to bring about the subsequent reaction. John L. Lewis is like to defy everybody, and he even wrote an article, I remember, in Collier's at the time. Lewis wrote the article titled, John L. Lewis, Public Enemy Number One. Good old John L., he's still around. They don't make them like that no more. I pause to pay respect to his memory. I like the guy. He is an orator, Shakespearean actor, a Bible quoter. He, during the sit-down strike up in Flint back in 37, I guess it was, when the fledgling United Automobile Workers was trying to organize General Motors in a very direct way. Why strike and see if the company can operate? Let's go to work and let's just not come out of the plant. We'll have our wives bring food in to us. And the governor of Michigan was reasonably sympathetic, so they got away with this. And John L. Lewis came in there because the mine workers were putting up a good deal of the money for this. Lewis was the first president of the CIL. He had a lot to do with the organization of the UAW and the United Steelworkers. Lewis came up there into the factory and went to the window on the shops. The militia was outside. The militia was pretty friendly. And he wasn't in great danger, but he ripped open his shirt, bared his hairy chest, and said, "If you must shoot down these working men, the bullets pass first through this breast." He thumped it. Now, where was I? Oh, yeah. Well, as a result now of public reaction, and the public feeling that we had gone too far in giving power to labor unions, we amended the Wagner Act. But this was a case where the amendment exceeds in length the original act. The Taft-Hartley Act, as it's called, which is really an amendment to the Wagner Act, sometimes it's been called the Lawyer's Full Employment Act. The Wagner Act is pretty simple, and you know what it means. The Taft-Hartley Act is very complex, and I don't have the slightest idea what some of it means. There's a section, I wish I had, I don't have a copy of it here, but there's section 8B, where you've got 8B1A, or 1, and another, you keep going down. It shall be an unfair labor practice for this to be done, provided that, unless, in the event that, unless, when you're all finished, you what it means. But what Congress basically did, now they did all sorts of things that I don't want to get into, like saying you shouldn't be an officer if you're a communist, you got to swear you're not, you know, so what you do is if you are a communist, you simply turn in your card on Tuesday, take the affidavit on Wednesday, and rejoin the party on Thursday. But anyway, Section 8B was a new addition. Section 8, remember, had been the section which listed all these unfair labor practices, all of the things that employers could not do, because if they did, they could be forced to make it up. In other words, if an employer fired a guy for union membership, and it was proved that this was the reason, or there was good reason to suspect this was the reason, he would have to put him back on the job and pay him all the back pay he lost. But now Congress added a bunch of unfair labor practices for unions. Fundamentally, what these unfair labor practices strive to prevent are these things. I'll just put them under three headings. Union coercion of employees, the enlistment of neutrals, jurisdictional strikes, and then really four, and then a potpourri of things, sort of a hash of abuses like high initiation fees, you know, $1,000 to get into our union, the closed shop, and feather bedding. Now, generally you know what all these things. Union coercion of employees, this is the thing where a guy doesn't want to join the union. He says, we don't want this union. Or the majority of employees working in a plant say, we don't want any union. Or maybe we want Union X, not Union Y. And Union Y comes along and forces the workers to take Union Y. This was the thing now that they wanted to prevent. That's union coercion of the employee. Enlistment of neutrals. Here the idea is the secondary strike, the secondary boycott. An attempt was made to limit this. For example, a union wants higher wages from a guy who's producing shirts. Textile factory, or apparel factory. So he won't give in, they have a strike, but they're not winning the strike. He brings in strike breakers and continues to operate the plant. So the union goes to big department stores in large cities and says, don't handle this guy's shirts. And they say, well, we're gonna handle these shirts. Then the union throws a picket line around the department store, and if it can get the cooperation of the truck drivers, can shut down the department store. Now, this clearly is the enlistment of a neutral, or is it the enlistment of a neutral? That's the problem. If the department store handles the shirts of the struck factory, is the department store still neutral? But anyway, this is the kind of thing that Congress was attempting to prevent. It tried to declare that secondary strikes and secondary boycotts were unfair labor practices, though it has never been able successfully to define a secondary strike or secondary boycott. A jurisdictional strike is one in which two unions get into a quarrel about who's going to do the work. This is the most senseless and the most frustrating kind of strike there is. Here's an employer who says, look, fellas, I'll bargain with any union. You choose the union. Now, two unions come along. The carpenters say, we'll bargain with you, and the brewers say, we'll bargain with you, and they can't agree on who's going to do the bargaining, and so you say the NLRB conducts an election. And the majority didn't choose the carpenters' union. And so the brewers say, all right, we'll strike, and they shut down your brewery. If it's a brewery you're running, choose this one. This happened in the famous case. Now, what can an employer do? He can't. He needs both kinds of workers, and whichever one he chooses, he's going to be shut down. It's the most frustrating sort of thing. Congress attempted to eliminate this. And then these high initiation fees, which were devices really to keep people out of the union and hence keep them off the job. The closed shop, which the difference between the closed shop and the union shop is this. Under a closed shop system, you must first join the union, then you can get a job. Under a union shop, you can get a job if the employer is willing to hire you, but then within a certain period of time, you must join the union. Now, the closed shop permits, obviously, some abuses that the union shop does not. If a union has a closed shop, it can also close the union and restrict the number of employees available. Very nice device. Feather bedding, well, you all know what feather bedding is. Turned out that Congress didn't really prevent feather bedding. It just prevented a certain... You know, the law says it shall be illegal or an unfair labor practice for a union to exact payment for work not done. But what Congress didn't say was that it would be illegal for a union to exact payment for work done though not wanted. So the device that unions have used to get around this is to simply have the employees do some work. Printers, for example, they're great feather bedders. They set a lot of bogus type. Here comes you got a big... advertisement, let's say. It's all set up because it was run in the morning news. And now, rather than get a new, do this work all over again, you just take that thing and send it over to the afternoon sun. But now that does the employees, the printers, over the afternoon sun out of some work. So you make a little piece of yellow paper and you hang it on a hook. And this is work that has to be done sometime. In other words, you reset all that type. When you're through resetting it, you throw it into the hell box and burn it down again. You don't use it, but you do the work. And this is perfectly okay, because here the union is exacting payment for work done. That means the work all has to be done. That means if that stuff gets, if that yellow, the pile of yellow slips back there gets pretty high, the foreman will come around, tell some of these guys get to work on the bogus. And they don't like that. Printer is a craftsman too, and he doesn't like it. Who wants to set a lot of type that's just going to be melted down afterwards? But that's the way she works. Well, now, one other thing here. I haven't said anything about the Sherman Act and antitrust. What happened there? Are unions combinations in restraint of trade? Now, this is a very controversial question, and I happen to think that the decision of the Supreme Court in 1940, written by Felix Frankfurter, by the way, who I think, Vern will tell you, I don't know anything about it, I think he is, my opinion, and I don't know anything about it, I think he's the greatest Supreme Court justice the United States has ever had. Not because he's a liberal or conservative, but because he strikes me as a wise man, and I think he has had respect for law. But anyway. Frankfurter wrote this decision in 1940 in a bit of a bind. Now, I have read criticisms of it. I'd say that, my gosh, how could he say any such thing? But I'm impressed with it. It seems to me that Frankfurter was taking the only possible way out. Here was the dilemma. Congress says in the Sherman Act, every combination in restraint of trade is illegal. Now, a union is clearly a combination and restraint of trade, whatever else it is. A union is a monopoly. Monopoly is a bad word, but let's get this straight. A union is a monopoly. If a union is not a monopoly, then union sympathizers have foisted a big bill of goods on their membership. This is precisely what a union is for. In unity, there is strength. we'll all get together and we'll combine, and by combining, we'll be able to get better terms than we'd be able to get if we hung separately. That's precisely what a union is supposed to do. I don't care if you don't like the word monopoly, let's call it a gumbazo. That's a neutral word. Union is a gumbazo. By that I mean a monopoly. Now union, if it's worth anything, is a monopoly. Congress says in the Sherman Act, thou shalt not be a monopoly. But Congress also says in the Norris-LaGuardia Act and in the Wagner Act, it is our policy to promote unions, i.e. monopolies. Now, what the courts must do when Congress contradicts itself is find a way to keep Congress from contradicting itself. It's got to save the law, you know. So, the courts held in 1940 that the Sherman Act did not apply to unions. Unions were exempted from its provisions. There's one exception. This is still the law. There's one exception. If a union combines with employers, then it loses its exemption. But as long as the union pursues its own interest, presumably that's what a union is going to do, and doesn't ring the employer in on the combination or conspiracy, it can do anything it wants to as far as the Sherman Act is concerned. It's still subject to other legal restrictions. But the Sherman Act won't get it as long as the union pursues its own interest and does not combine with employers. Now, this was called the interlaced construction of the Sherman Act, that in deciding how the Sherman Act was to apply to unions, Congress was reading the Sherman Act through subsequent legislation, particularly the Clayton Act, which is a commentary on the Sherman Act, and the Norris-LaGuardia Act, which was a commentary on the Clayton Act. Well, that's the way we are today. Many people have protested, and it disturbs me a little bit. Some of my very conservative friends have said, here we pass a good law like the Sherman Act, and the courts just stick their big clammy paw in there and pull unions out and mess the whole thing up. Well, Justice Black, just a few years later, put it as plain as day in reaffirming this 1940 decision in the Hutchison case, which had to do with a jurisdictional strike, carpenters against brewers. Justice Black said, many will say this has the effect of removing unions completely from the provisions of the Sherman Act. Whether this is good or bad is not for us to say. It is a matter for the determination of Congress. It is difficult to find a clearer invitation by the Supreme Court to Congress to change the law if Congress was not satisfied with the court's interpretation. Congress has had now 23 years to do so, and hasn't, or 25 years to do so, and hasn't done so. So why blame the Supreme Court? I think the court was in a bind, and it took the only way out. Congress could have provided another way out, although I'll have to admit now it would be extraordinarily difficult politically for Congress to do that. But still, if Congress doesn't like the court's interpretation of the law, this interlaced construction, let Congress clarify for the benefit of the court. One other law. Now, in 1959, in the wake of the racketeering investigations, which brought then Senator Kennedy, now late President Kennedy, to fame, and also his brother, in the wake of these racketeering investigations, which I think, as usual, were more sound and fury than sense, we passed a new law, the Secretary of Labor's Headache Bill. The Landrum-Griffin Act, the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, requires unions to keep a record of everything they do. You read that law, if they're obeying it today, must have had to about double their clerical staffs just to get the records in. The idea was that we were going to now check closely on internal union affairs because we had uncovered evidence of all kinds of abuses, dues being siphoned off into the pocket of corrupt labor leaders, and goon squads beating up on workers and workers not being allowed to speak at union meetings. And we're going to control all of this stuff. Now, that's where we are today. That's, in sum, is the state of federal labor law. State labor law isn't usually too much different. That's a sweeping statement. But after you can't begin on that. Now, to go back to the point with which I began. The federal authority to pass a nosy law, like Landrum Griffin is, a meddling, interfering law, seems to me to have been implicit in the passage of the Wagner Act. What we have done, I would like to stress this now, it's a matter of public policy. We have singled out labor unions as objects of special concern and congressional affection. We have said that for some reason, that's what we want to get into Wednesday, what exactly is that reason? We want to build up labor unions. We have said that in the absence of special privileges, special government support, unions could not become strong enough to do the things we want them to do. Therefore, we're going to give them an assist. Now, the question becomes this. What is it that we were trying to do, and have we succeeded in doing it? Where did we come out? And is there maybe some folly in what we attempted to do, or did we miss the mark? Wednesday, I'm going to get mostly into economics. And because I wouldn't want to give the thing away. Now I'll tell you where I'm going to come up. But I've got to quit my watch. That clock is quite wrong. Those of you who are worried, my watch says 20 after 9. I got 10 minutes yet, and I'm sure there may be something that would require clarification or refutation. Vern, is there anything I said that badly needs to be refuted?
No. There's one place where I'm a little
with any other union? Is this the truth?
Any other union at all, whatever union or anybody else. It's much the same sort of thing that you see with cooperative organizations. Mm-hmm. A co-op may form for the purpose of collecting marketing, buying whatever person to do. But having once formed, it may not include a training contract with any other organization. So we have that recent.
This was 14B was added to the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, came along. 14B says that nothing in this law, nothing in the National Labor Relations Act now, should be assumed to make a union security clause valid in a state where it's invalid. Now, what's a union security clause? Union security clause is the device to give security to the union. The closed shop is one example. That's the best form of union security clause from the union standpoint. It guarantees that nobody works on the job unless the union first approves it. Now, that puts the union in a real nice, secure position. Next best would be the union shop, where the union signs a contract with an employer that states that, well, the employer may hire whomever he will. That employee must join the union within 30 or 60 days, or else he'll be discharged. Here the union guarantees that everybody who comes onto the job is going to be paying dues after a short period of time. Usually begins right away. You go to a steel mill, ask for a job, they give you all the forms, you know, all your bibliographic data, along with it, an application for membership in the union. And you just automatically fill it out, and they start checking off your dues. There are other minor forms. There's preferential hiring, there's maintenance membership agreement, and so on. But now, a number of states, it shifts a little bit, I think there are 19 at the present time, 19 or 20, have what they call right-to-work laws, which I want to talk about whether they are right-to-work laws. But anyway, they're laws which, to some degree, restrict the power of unions and employers to enter into this kind of agreement. For example, a typical right-to-work law will state that it's illegal for an employer to discriminate against a worker for membership or non-membership in a labor union, and illegal for a union to try to force him to do so, or for them to execute any contract which would discriminate. Well, now that pretty much does it. That eliminates the union shop and the closed shop. But now, here's the trouble. The doctrine exists at law that when Congress acts in an area where it has the power to act, it preempts the area. That's a necessary doctrine. Because if all the states are allowed to go messing around in, say, regulating interstate commerce, where Congress has the authority to act, it's going to be pretty jumbly. A decision that was, as I understand, based on this doctrine largely, was a decision out in Pennsylvania with a communist. We have a Smith Act in the United States laws, which forbids a guy, keeps him from teaching and advocating the violent overthrow of the government. Well, Pennsylvania wasn't satisfied, and they passed their own Little Smith Act, which made it illegal also to teach and advocate the violent overthrow of Pennsylvania. They racked up this guy, his name was Nelson, remember the Communist Party, and his conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court on the grounds that Congress had preempted the area. Isn't that right? Yeah. That you can't have federal government legislated here, states keep your hands up. All right, now the federal government legislated in this area of union security agreements, at least as far as interstate commerce is concerned. And the Taft-Hartley law, though it outlaws the closed shop, specifically states that the union shop is legal under certain circumstances, certain safeguards. Now, what's going to control? The state of Texas says no union shop, no closed shop. Federal law says closed shop, no, union shop, okay. Under the doctrine of preemption here, Texas would have no right to forbid the union shop for workers in interstate commerce. And so Congress inserted 14B, which is a specific withdrawing of federal power, saying, now, federal power takes over here, except in this area. And what it amounts to, then, is that the more restrictive legislation has effect. Thus, in the state of Texas, in the state of New York, where I believe the closed shop is illegal under New York law, and so it's illegal. Only the union shop is illegal. The federal law prohibits closed shop, and that won't go in New York. State law prohibits both union and the closed shop illegal.
Our unions were very anxious to get that. And Johnson had promised that he would try to get a good deal, but I think Johnson was biding his time. For a number of good reasons, to open a real order. It's a very complex question. And it's losing a lot of goodwill. Another thing, too, as long as you keep this in reserve, you can gain a lot of support. This is important to the business community. That's the symbolic reason. It's important to labor unions, too.
And if the president just waits, you know, I won't tell you whether you can go to the movie or not. Let's see how you guys behave. he's got a nice whip in his hand. But we want to get into Wednesday. We want to get into the question of the right to work and right to work laws. Vern, Washington had a referendum on that some years back, and they rejected it. Yeah. Yeah, as I recall, he's again right to work laws, isn't he? All right, I'll take a peek. It's good to know what the Pope says. Well, all right, it's time to stretch and get your smoke or wander out in the rain or something. I am in charge of physical education program here. And stand up and stretch. Put your hands up as high as they'll go and get on your tiptoes, you know, and put them out like this. Feels good. Then collapse in your chair. But after you've stretched your arms, then the other thing you've got to do is go down on your tiptoes, see, and stretch your legs. Stay on your tiptoes. Do that about 27 times. And then, you know, there's a muscle you missed. Get up on your heels. Hang on to something, your wife preferably, that if you fall, you'll knock her over and she'll be on the bottom. And get up as high as you can on your heels and stretch those back. It's great if you plan to take a hike. You see, then if you fall off a cliff and are injured, your muscles won't atrophy. You'll be able to do this before help comes.